Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome. We're so glad to have you with us here this evening on Ask Herbal Health Expert Susan Weed, a two-hour radio show each Tuesday night. Herbal medicine is people's medicine, simple, safe, effective. Please bring your curiosity and health questions. Susan will enlighten, surprise, and delight you. I know most of you know Susan Weed already. She's my mom, so I know her. But for those of you who have not yet met Susan, I'd like to share. She is the author of the Wise Woman Herbal Series, five wonderful books on women's health and herbal medicine, including Wise Woman Herbal for the Childbearing Year, Breast Cancer, Breast Health! The Wise Woman Way, Healing Wise, The Wise Woman Herbal, New Menopausal Years, The Wise Woman Way, and Susan's latest book, Down There, Sexual and Reproductive Health, The Wise Woman Way. In addition to being the editor at Ash Tree Publishing and writing her books, Susan is the director of the Wise Woman Center in Woodstock, New York. The Wise Woman Center is open to the public on appointment-only basis. She offers weekend workshops, intensives, and apprenticeships throughout the season. Susan is also available to you online via wisewomanmentor.com. There you can go and view her weekly e-zine. You can subscribe to receive a notification via email each week, or you could join her mentorship program. Susan also offers distance learning correspondence courses and online courses at the Wise Woman University. But you can also just go to her website, susanweed.com, where you will find thousands of pages online with recipes, articles, art features, and so much more. Well, for now, let's see what Susan has to share with us this evening. Thank you, and welcome, Susan.
Thank you, Justine. It's always a delight to be introduced by you. And how are you tonight, Rebecca?
I am doing well. Sitting in this room full of linden on the floor.
Hey, bowl of linden. Yes, indeed. Elder is blooming here. Justine and I did a video of me, a YouTube video of me making elderflower champagne.
Oh, awesome. I actually harvested some elderflower today myself down by the river.
And, yeah, they like it wet.
Yeah, and just made a small tincture of it, but... Yeah, it's good to have on hand when you have little ones around.
It's so important. It's so effective, that elderflower tincture, at bringing those fevers down.
Mm-hmm. It really is.
I had a friend who had a concussion, and one of the things that happened as she was healing from her concussion was that her fever control mechanism didn't work right. And every night as the sun would go down, her fever would start to come up. And it'd be 99, 100, 101, 102. And the first couple of nights, you know, the first night we called the hospital. We said, oh, should we bring her in? Her fever's 103. And the nurse on duty said, well, yeah, if you want to pay $100 for two aspirin, bring her in. But that's all we'll do is give her aspirin. You can do that at home.
Yeah.
And explained to me that that's what had happened. It is a part of the concussion. And so I said, thank you very much, and put the phone down and thought, I can do even better than that. I have elder blossom tincture. I don't even need to use aspirin.
Yeah.
And so we got her through that.
And I find the tea is really effective as well. So if you don't have the tincture made, then tea is really
the
a
tea.
Strong
and that's just
tea.
A, That's just a fast brew. What do you use, like a tablespoon of the flowers or more?
I usually just fill up the tea. Probably a third of a cup inside of like a cup and a half of water, and make it really pretty strong.
Nice.
And then
it's said to restore health to the fever control mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
In the brain.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
So
that it's not like it's just turning off the fever, because, in fact, that fever is functional. We run a fever because most bacteria and most viruses are slowed down in their growth when they get hot.
Yeah.
Not all of them, but fortunately a lot of them that are problems for us can be slowed down by heat, and so the body turns up the fire. So you don't necessarily want to go in there and, you know, just make the body stop having a fever, because that's kind of like saying, oh, you're wrong, you should let this infection go on.
Mm-hmm.
So elder, rather than being a febrifuge, and there are plenty of herbs that are febrifuges like yarrow or mint, elder does something very different in terms of being able to lower fever.
So it allows you to sweat through your pores? Is that kind of like what draws the fever out more?
No. Diaphoretic herb is an herb that opens your pores and makes you sweat.
Okay.
And certainly if you sweat, you might get chilled afterwards because you have moisture on your body. But that's part of the heroic idea that the fever is somehow a bad something in your body, some nasty stuff in your body that has to be removed. So you have to be poked, you have to be puked, you have to be purged.
Mm-hmm.
And diaphoresis is seen as purging. Have you ever owned a dog? Do you own a dog now? I don't know.
Yes, I do.
Have you ever come in from working really hard in the garden or running and just really be covered in sweat? What does your dog do?
Licks me.
How come?
Because I'm salty. Probably.
That's right. That's all you're losing in your sweat is minerals. There are no toxins of any kind in human sweat. No supposed toxins from fevers, which don't exist. And no toxins from chemicals, which do exist. No, and this is one of the reasons why we don't suggest that women go in the sweat lodge. During their fertile years, going in the sweat lodge could actually result in birth defect if the woman was pregnant and didn't know it. And then after menopause, when you're not in your childbearing years, sweating just removes your bones. And at those ages, we don't need our bones removed. So fun as it is chatting with you, I feel the mildest pang of guilt that someone might be waiting on the phone.
Yeah, we have two callers waiting, so we'll go for the 714 area code.
Hi,
hello,
Susan, 714
area code. How are you tonight?
Hi, Susan, it's Kathy. Hello, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Oh, good.
Kathy, my blind friend.
Yes, and no worries. I could listen to you and Rebecca talking all day. It's fascinating. And one of these days, I really want to taste dandelion wine and elderflower champagne.
I am actually sitting here drinking a glass of elderflower champagne, even as we speak.
What does it taste like?
It tastes like sleeping under an elder bush on summer solstice when the fairies come and dust you all over with fairy dust.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, that sounds wonderful. And it has a little alcohol in it. Of course, it's champagne, so how nice.
It does fizz, and I'm told that there's a natural yeast on the elderflowers.
Uh-huh.
Because we don't add any yeast to it. It's very simple. Basically, you dissolve a pound of sugar in some boiling water. You've measured the water beforehand, so you have a gallon of boiling water. You just use some of it to dissolve the sugar, and then you pour all the rest of it in and add a couple of lemons sliced up or 2 tablespoons of lemon juice and a handful of dried organic lemon peel and a couple of tablespoons of vinegar and 7 heads of elderflowers. Cover it up, wait 24 hours, bottle it, and it's ready to drink pretty quickly, a couple of weeks if you want. Although the one that I'm drinking right now, I made 10 years ago, The Apprentices and I.
Oh, nice.
So it ages
Susan,
well.
Yeah, I can't. Oh, yes. I'll have to look for the video when you guys get it up on YouTube. So.
Yes, indeed. When we gals do it, it should. As a matter of fact, Justine said she was going home and posting it immediately. Now, we know how life is. It does not always play according to the way we want to play, but I'm sure it'll be up there soon.
Oh, thank you again for taking my call, Susan. I have maybe three questions. One of them is about tincturing, and I want to tincture dandelion, as I'm really loving this dandelion I can buy at my Sprouts here, but I want to make my own. And if I understand the information that I've read so far, is that I can tincture any part of the dandelion, the roots, the dried dandelion. Can you help me with that to make sure I'm thinking in the right way?
Yes. Dandelion is a very gracious and generous plant. Any part of it can be prepared in any way, just about any day of the year, and result in effective medicine. If we want to get a little more precise about it, and we don't need to, then we can say that tinctures and vinegars and oils made from fresh plant material are always a lot better than those made from dried plant material. So whenever we can, we use fresh plant material. If we want to make a tincture of something that we can't get hold of fresh, then if it's a root or a berry, we can use dried plant material, although not optimum. As a matter of fact, it's one of the things sometimes students say to me, oh, is there something I can do for you? And I say, yes, you live where this and such grows. Harvest me some and overnight air it to me so that I can tincture it fresh. And I know that students sometimes do tincture exchanges, that one person tinctures more than she could use of a plant that's local to her area and then exchanges with others who've done the same thing in that way. You all get some from all the areas you're interested in. So if we're going to make a tincture from a fresh plant, we chop the plant with a knife and fill a jar. If we don't cut the plant, we're not going to get enough plant into the jar, so it's very important to chop the plant up. And we put it in the jar until the jar is full. Now, most plants are about 75% water. That means that when you dry a plant, you have, at the end, 1/4 of the volume that you started with. So if you start with 4 ounces of dandelion root, by the time you're done, you're only going to have 1 ounce of dandelion root. With dandelion root, you might actually have a little more because it's a root, so it's a little denser. With something like a chickweed leaf, you might actually have a little bit less. But that 3/4 ratio is a good ratio. So then if we are using dried plant material, we would fill our jar only 1/3 to 1/4 full with dried plant material, which would be the equivalent of filling it full of fresh plant material. Do your best to remember that the dried plant material is going to absorb liquid and expand. And if you fill your jar full of dried plant material and then put some kind of liquid like vodka over it, you could very well explode your jar. I had harvested some yellow dock seeds to make some yellow dock seed vinegar. And I hadn't realized that the day was really dry and it hadn't rained for days and it was a pretty dry summer. And so those yellow dock seeds that I'd made vinegar of before expanded. Fortunately, I had put them in a jar that was corked. And so all I had was the mess of vinegar and seeds that had spewed out of the jar rather like a volcano, but not broken glass. Right. So the dried plant material, one-third to one-quarter of the jar full, and then the jar filled to the top with your tincturing medium. I prefer 100-proof vodka. Does that help clarify it for you?
It does. And then I have some access to some fresh honeysuckle flowers, which I was thinking, and I'd never seen this online, but can I take that and infuse it in some maybe jojoba oil? Olive oil might overpower it, but I want to make something that smells good. Would that work? Honeysuckle smells so delicious.
Some plants, their smells move into oil, and some not so much. Some plants that have really strong smells, their smell doesn't move into oil. Some, it will move into oil, but it will only stay there a brief time, and then you're just back to oil again. But give it a try. As I always say about trying things out with herbs, I won't tell you that I personally have wasted more money and more time on going to a movie that I didn't really like than I have wasted on trying to make an herbal remedy that I didn't really like.
There you go.
Right? You
then
make something you don't like, you say, that one didn't work.
Yeah.
It's going to be good jojoba oil. Well, no matter what happens, you pour the jojoba oil over the honeysuckle flowers, and 6 weeks later you smell it. It smells like jojoba oil and not honeysuckle. You say, all right, well, I can still use it on my body.
Yeah, and it still has the benefits. I would imagine honeysuckle has some really nice healing benefits to it.
Yes.
Right.
It's quite renowned in China. It's a very important healing herb in China. But let's go on to the next question so we can get them all.
Good. So my husband has on his scalp, and I wonder if there's a treatment for it that would be safe. It was diagnosed as actinic keratosis. So it is a type of precancerous lesion. However, it's not red like it's been described online. It's not red. It's the color of his scalp. So I wonder if that was a misdiagnosis for one thing. But secondly, I've seen one place where it says you can use picado gel, which is a kind of weed. And so I thought I'd ask Susan what she could help him try to make sure this doesn't turn into cancer or even get rid of it and heal it.
Well, that's interesting, what you're saying. A spot suddenly appeared on the upper part of my shoulder. It was pretty big, bigger than a pencil eraser, and the edge wasn't even. And I said, two out of three. It's big, the edge is uneven, it's not raised, it's, you know, not discolored. It's a little darker than my skin. But I thought, I'll go see a dermatologist anyhow. And she looked at me and she said, it's a keratosis, no big deal. Forget it. So she certainly didn't seem to think that a keratosis was precancerous.
And it wasn't red, like his is not red. It's just
exactly
rough and scaly.
Yeah, my little thing is kind of rough too. Not like, not like an unshaved chin rough, but just a little rougher than the surrounding skin.
It feels like scabbies. It feels like scabs to me when I touch it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
mine isn't that rough. So there are a variety of things that can be and that have been used. Anything from red clover oil, which is used to dissolve unwanted growth, to the sap of celandine, which has to be used fresh, and a whole host of other things in between, soothing things, astringent things. It's kind of fun to have something like that and to try a bunch of different things. I had turned out to be a piece of glass in my foot, but I didn't know, and it took me almost 6 weeks to get it to come out of my foot, and I tried a different poultice every night of that 6 weeks. Just wonderful. The very strongest of all the poultices was what we call patty pan squash or flying saucer squash. and that grated on and applied, I really felt like my foot was going to turn inside out. Zucchini, of course, and winter squash. Pumpkin, which is even used in facials for the same thing, because it really helps to remove what are often called surface blemishes.
What finally worked?
All of it. Which is why I learned to stick with one thing so that I could then tell a story later.
That's right. Yeah, because all those things over 6 weeks, it could have been anything. Or all of them.
Mm-hmm.
I like that. I like that.
It's like the, I think it's a Gaelic story about the woman of power who is making an elixir of long life, or an elixir of eternal life, and she has to put a new herb in her cauldron every day for a year to make this elixir.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, huh?
That's quite an elixir. So the final thing, and this is really quick, but, you know, my husband, I want to protect his vision. He's taking drops for glaucoma, and he also has a cataract that his ophthalmologist wants him to remove. But I think it's pretty successful, the surgery on the cataracts these days. But I remember you saying your mom, it actually made her vision worse. It's probably unlikely to happen.
Not what I said. I said it made her vision a lot better.
Oh, what's it? Oh, I took it the other way. Oh.
She said it was the best year of vision that she ever had in her entire life. She couldn't remember even as a child being able to see so well.
Oh, my goodness. So he should just do it, and that's, yeah.
We can help ourselves prepare for surgery by drinking our nourishing herbal infusions, by eating a non-inflammatory diet, by asking for help from our friends. I had very minor surgery, a hernia repair. And I asked my friends to please be with me, and I knew what time the surgery was going to be. And so I gave them the date and the time, and I asked them to be there. And I woke up that morning, and I felt surrounded by love. And I was so buoyed up and so overjoyed with all of this loving kindness that was coming to me. So when the nurse came around with the pill, I said, what is that? She said, it's a pill to make you feel good. And I looked at her, and I just laughed. And I said, no pill could make me feel anywhere near as good as I feel right now. And so, of course, I did not take it. And later on, as we were all, because it's a hernia clinic, and so a few people were prepared at once, and in the ante room to the surgery, and there was a very, very nervous young man there, a teenager. And they were debating as to whether or not to give him a second dose of the, we'll make you feel good medicine. And one of the nurses said, just have him go and sit by her, pointing at me. And they did. They wheeled him over. We were in the obligatory wheelchairs. They just wheeled him over to sit next to me. We didn't even have to talk. Joy and the love that was being poured into me from my friends was plenty to spill over into him, and he too went into his surgery smiling.
But you're a good receiver too, Susan, and that's part of
Well, I think we're
this,
all good receivers if we allow ourselves to be.
That's right. That's right,
yeah.
If we allow it. Aww.
If we allow it, we have to ask for it, and then we have to allow it. And the way we become better is by doing it. So
that's
whether
right.
we're good or not so good, well, gosh, if we're not so good, all the more reason to do it, right?
Oh, thank you. You're an angel. I will
so that we
tell
can get
my
better at it.
Things. Yes.
All right.
Yes.
All right, dear Kathy, let's
thank
let the next caller through, shall we?
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye now. Green
bless
you.
Okay, the next caller in the 603 area code.
Yes. Thank you, Susan. Delighted to talk to you again. I'm Rose, and I'm the one who called at the end a couple weeks ago. If you could talk more about comfrey, please. I have never dried it, and I'm looking forward to it. I have some out in the garden now that was given to me by a friend, and I would love it if you could walk me through how to do that. The first time is always a little scary for me, but I'm looking forward to it. Yes.
Well, I sat with the comfrey for a while, and I said, you know, all the books say leaves, so should it just be your leaves? Like, I see that you have, like, this long leaf stalk coming up, and if you look at the comfrey, when it's just kind of emerging like a fountain from the ground, you'll see these very long leaf stalks, which technically are called petioles, which I think is a wonderful word. And the comfrey said, well, yes, you know, the root really is the part that's often used. And so I began to read and to talk to people. And it turns out that along with the problematic alkaloids, the pyrrolizidine alkaloids that are found in the root, and sometimes in the above-ground parts of some kinds of comfrey, that there's another alkaloid called allantoin. And allantoin is the major healing alkaloid in comfrey. It's the one that really, like, knits things together and ties things together and makes things flexible and strong, which is what I think of comfrey as, is flexible and strong. An allantoin is found in proportion to the hardness of the comfrey material. So there's more allantoin in the root because the root is hard. And then there's allantoin in the petiole, in that leaf stalk, because that's hard, and in the midrib of the leaf because that's harder, and the least of the allantoin is actually in the leafy material. So as I sat with the comfrey and as I sat with it through its growing season, I saw that comfrey really did something very interesting as it started to flower. I was talking about that fountaining up of the leaves from the root, and then as it comes into a flower, suddenly this big, tall flower stalk shoots up from the comfrey. Depending on where the comfrey is growing, it can get 4 feet high, 5 feet high. I have seen them 6 and 7 feet high, indeed. And from this uncurl at the top these beautiful sprays of flowers. In the garden comfrey, those flowers are usually purple to kind of mauve, lavender, lilac, even kind of a dark pink, sometimes even fading to a whitish, pinky whitish kind of color. But they are big, and I felt that flowering stalk, and it was hard. And I said to the comfrey, flowering stalk, and the comfrey nodded her head and said, I think that's the best thing to do. So that's what I do. Rather than harvesting the individual leaves and then having all that labor of dealing with the individual leaves, I simply cut the flowering stalks of the comfrey, and most of the comfrey roots will have many flowering stalks. I wait until they're at least in flower bud. I actually prefer to wait until the first flowers are opening, but not, if I can, so late that the flowers are all open and the bees are not interested. I like to see the bees around when I'm harvesting the comfrey. Like with any high-protein herb, I don't want to harvest too much at once. If I have a big comfrey patch, then I'll only harvest for, say, 10 minutes and take it inside and hang it up to dry and then go back out and harvest some more. Also want to be careful about comfrey on bare arms, because comfrey is a kind of scratchy plant, and you won't notice it, but if you pick up a big double armload of it from the ground and the stalks are that long that you stick both arms under it and carry it to where you're going to hang it up to dry, you could very well get a rash all over the inner parts of your arms. That could be at the most itchy and uncomfortable for a day. It's not going to be any big deal, but it's not pleasant, as one of my friends says. Well, it's not the end of the world, but it certainly isn't pleasant, she says, and that is absolutely true. We're going to hang our comfrey flowering stalks one by one. Now, I'm going to see if I can turn something that's a visual into words. It's difficult, but we'll try. rather than taking some string and winding it around and around the comfrey and tying it in a knot and then tying a loop on it and hanging it up that way, we are going to take our string and we are going to take a piece of string about 8 to 10 inches long, and we're going to bend it so that the two cut ends are laying next to each other, not facing each other, not nose to nose, but laying next to each other so that the string is, in a sense, folded in half. And we are then going to tie an overhand knot in the two pieces of string at once, turning it into a loop because our knot is out toward the cut ends of the string. So now we have a loop of string with a knot at one place and two ends sticking out of that knot. We are going to take our individual comfrey stalk, and we are not going to put it through the loop. We are going to put the loop to one side of the stalk so that we can pass the knot through the open end of the loop, catching the comfrey stalk in the little noose we have created by putting the knot through the open end. If you're not quite following along, try it, and you'll get it. I also think there you might be able to see this on some of the YouTubes where you're seeing us hanging a herb up to dry. I like to have ceilings with strips of molding that I can put push pins or thumbtacks approximately every 4 to 6 inches along that. And then I have a drawer full of these loops. I pick up a comfrey stalk. I put the knot through the open end of the loop with the comfrey stalk caught in between, reach up and hang it and do the next one and the next one and the next one. And it goes very, very quickly. And if you pull that tight enough, the comfrey usually won't fall out. When is the comfrey dry? When the hardest part of it, and that is the stalk, is completely dry. The leaves will dry first. They'll be dry and rustly, but it's not dry yet. We have to wait until the comfrey stalk breaks, or at least isn't bendy. You'll see it takes longer than you think it will for that comfrey stalk to completely dry out. But give it that 10 days or 12 days or 14 days, whatever it needs, especially if you live in a place that's very humid, to protect against the easy inclination to bring down any dried herb too soon before it's really dry. Bring it down and put it into brown paper bags, not jars, not plastic bags, certainly not anything that seals. By putting it in a brown paper bag, you let the last little bit of moisture in your drying herb evaporate out through the brown paper and yet protect it from varmints and light as well. So I hope that's not too complicated an answer.
No, it was wonderful. I was fascinated listening to it. I do have some questions, and I hope they don't sound silly. But
I don't think there's any silly questions.
Okay. Well. So what I understand you just told me, Susan, is that I'm going to cut the whole plant at the ground level, including the which includes the blossoms, so everything hanging. The whole plant, and I guess I'm hanging it upside down in this loop.
Correct.
Okay.
But you're not.
But
hang on just a second. You're not putting it in the loop. You're wrapping the loop around it.
Wrapping the loop around it. I will have to experiment. I don't know if I quite get it, but maybe if I play with it. Now,
well,
is this the only
the loop,
way that
loop like
is
a rubber
the only
band
way
is,
that you've ever dried it?
That's the way to dry it. Yes.
That is the way. Okay. Now, this is the question that might sound stupid. I don't know. If I didn't call you, I probably would have thought of chopping it up and then drying it like in a dehydrator. Is that totally, totally unacceptable?
Yes.
Can you tell me why?
there is oxygen in the air.
Okay.
And oxygen is an incredibly caustic, transformative substance. It literally burns everything it touches. Where it touches metal, it rusts it. Where it touches us, it makes wrinkles. Where it touches herbs, it causes oxidation and the breakdown of chemical constituents. What causes oxidation is cutting. So we never want to cut a plant that we're drying. Conversely, when we're making a tincture, we want all that surface area exposed, but it's not going to be exposed to oxygen, because we're pouring vodka right over it. Or we're pouring vinegar right over it. Or we're pouring oil right over it, and thus blocking the oxygen. Yes, you buy herbs, cut and sift, but they are dried first and cut afterwards. And one of the advantages of drying your own herb is that you can keep it whole until near the time when you're ready to use it. I have whole stalks of comfrey that retain all of their medicinal potency that are over 12 years old.
Oh, when you keep them in the paper bags?
Just in the paper bag. Once that herb is cut up, it's good for a year.
And now, you did mention when you began that you only use the stalk, but you're drying the entire plant, so when they're dry, do you discard?
I did not say only.
Oh, okay. I misunderstood. Sorry.
I said the flowering stalk.
Okay. Okay.
Obviously includes the leaves and the flowers that are on it. I did not at any point say take the leaves off the stalk, did I?
No, you didn't. I misunderstood. I got to be a better listener. Okay, so I think that's what you referred to as all the aerial parts. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, now I get it. And I'm out here with my little crop, and the bees are around it. They just haven't started to blossom, but some of them, I guess it looks like some of the blossoms have fallen, but they still have blossoms, and there's still bees hovering. So is that still okay, or is it too late?
Absolutely. The bees will tell.
So
if the bees are there, they're saying it's good.
Okay. Okay. That's great.
Now, can you also see that when you cut the flowering stalk, there's still plenty of leaves that are going to be left?
Let's see. I'm going right up to it now. Let's see.
Mm-hmm.
Plenty of leaves left. You mean beside this one stalk? I mean, coming
yeah.
out of the stalk?
Yeah.
If I cut it to the ground...
There's other leaves coming out of the comfrey root, and there's a flowering stalk.
Yes. I actually have...
So you're not like wiping everything out at ground level. You're cutting the flowering stalk at ground level.
Yes. Yes. So
there's still going to be plenty of leaves left there.
Okay. And I believe...
And depending on where you live, comfrey might flower twice, or it might flower three times.
Yes, okay.
You can harvest it more than once a year.
Okay, and I didn't quite get what you meant when you said harvest one at... I know what you said about possibly getting the rash, but if I'm out here and I have like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 stalks, I can harvest them all if I'm careful the way I carry them in and not... or should I always leave one?
You don't have to leave any.
I don't have to leave any. Okay.
No,
well,
you can harvest
them.
Well,
I can't wait to do this. This is so exciting. If I may ask something else, please. I went to your e-zine for the first time, and I was very excited when I saw your list of things that you put in your salad. Like 30 or something. I couldn't find it tonight. My computer's on. I couldn't get there tonight. I went during the week, and I was fascinated by everything that you harvested and put in your salad, and I was comparing notes to what I have harvested. So that was extremely interesting. So I thank you for that. And the other thing
you're welcome.
You mentioned that you had harvested purple or the red clover and the white clover blossoms for your salad. I have yellow clover. I've been including that. Is that okay?
Are you taking a blood thinning drug?
Oh, no drugs.
Is anyone who's eating your salad taking a blood thinning drug?
No.
Then you're fine.
Okay, have you eaten the yellow ones?
Well, I don't, of course, really know what you mean since there's at least half a dozen different yellow clovers. There's yellow sweet clover, which is very high in blood thinning compounds, which is Melilotus officinalis. There's also there's also Melilotus lotus, which is poor man's clover, which is a beautiful yellow clover. There's also the hop clover in my area, and a black metic clover, which is a yellow clover. So there's quite a few yellow clovers.
And they're all edible? Have this blood thinning problem?
Well, let me ask you this. If you planted peas, would you eat the flowers?
Sure.
Then
uh-huh.
It's the same family, right? It's the pea and bean family.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so they're
usually,
all edible.
Usually flowering parts in that family are edible. There are a few weirdos, shall we say, in the family. Loco weed is in this family.
Loco
and
weed?
And soy. Loco weed. Crazy weed. And soy, which is certainly not a friend to us.
Loco weed, did you say it's soy?
I said there are at least two plants in this family that are not healthy for us. Loco weed and soy.
Oh, okay. Yes, I don't eat any soy. Loco weed is a new one. I'm going to have to look that one up. Is that in one of your books?
No, if you don't live in the desert southwest, it won't be growing near you.
Oh, good. Okay, I don't have to worry about that then. Okay. Well, that was extremely helpful. I thank you for that. And green blessings, and to you, and thank you so much for your help.
Green blessings to you. Good night.
Good night.
All right, we have a couple more callers here. So in the 406 area code.
That's me. This is Gwen, and I called in a few weeks ago about having had gallbladder surgery.
Yes. How are you doing, Gwen?
I'm doing actually pretty good. This week has been the best so far. And I've had some questions then about comfrey, some of which you've answered now. But I'm also interested in knowing about anything that would be good for continuing to recover from the anesthesia, because I generally don't do well with stuff like that. So the question I had about the comfrey that you were just discussing is, what kind of space do you dry it in? Like a room in the house, or do you have to have a special shed for it, or what are you using?
You can dry it in your house. That's not a problem at all. What you're looking for, in terms of a space for drying herb, you don't want it to be where there's light, and you don't want it to be where it's wet. So you wouldn't want it to be like in a basement too wet or a sun porch too sunny. Attics are good because they're hot and air moves through them usually if there's a fan or a vent in the attic. So people often dry in attics. Or if you have a room and it doesn't have big windows, it doesn't have south-facing or east-facing windows, or you can curtain those windows. Comfrey stalks are big. when they are hanging from the ceiling, they will reach almost to the floor. So it's not like you could hang them in your bedroom and be able to get around.
Okay. Unfortunately, my main room I was thinking about has giant cathedral windows. So I'll have to adapt to the back room, I guess, for those. But I think that I could.
Okay.
So,
did you say the back room?
Yeah, a room in the back of the house.
In the back. Okay, I just wanted to be sure that you hadn't said bath.
Oh, no.
Okay,
no,
good.
I get it.
That would be too wet. Exactly. You're right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then there had been some questions that I had asked before that you said to bring up on a call-in show because it was too long to type out an answer, which had to do with comfrey officinale versus comfrey uplandica. So the plants that I've actually purchased and planted the roots are the uplandica. But what I have purchased that I have quite a lot of, the dried herb already, says on the package officinale. And I came from Eastern Europe somewhere. I can't remember the country at the moment. So am I okay to use that until I have grown my own? To use it internally?
Here's what I can tell you. I have bought dried commercial comfrey from Frontier Herbs for more than 25 years. Oh, you still there?
Yes. Uh-huh.
All right. And it is what, in addition to my own herb, it is what I use. And so I use quite a bit of it. My sweetheart, and it is labeled Symphytum officinale, not for human consumption. It is what we use. My really likes comfrey and probably drinks twice as much as I do. So he probably drinks between 6 to 10 quarts of comfrey a month. And I probably consume 5 to 6 quarts of comfrey a month. And for something totally unrelated, he had his liver function tested last year, and he was at the top of functioning ability for his age group. So as far as I am concerned, all of the comfrey that is being sold is mislabeled. But you will have to decide for yourself if it's safe to use. I will tell you this. There have been no reports of any kind that I've been able to find of anyone having any problem of any kind from using any kind of comfrey leaf. It is certainly possible that pyrrolizidine alkaloids could be in the comfrey leaf, but they are concentrated in the root. And we are talking leaf here. So, right. So I don't know what to say except that the few reports that we have of there's two neonatal deaths which appear to have been caused by comfrey, excessive use of comfrey root. And there was, I believe, at least one woman in the United States who was taking 10 to 20 comfrey pepsin pills a day, which were comfrey root, and did have some liver distress, which wound up in the hospital, and as soon as they got her off the comfrey, her liver returned to normal. So I have heard people say, you know, pretty outrageous things like comfrey silently destroys your liver and then one day you wake up dead, but I have never seen any stories, reports, scientific studies, or anything of the kind that would lead me to believe that's true. Let me put it an exclamation point on this. I have one child, a daughter. She has one child, a daughter. So I have one daughter and one granddaughter. When my daughter was pregnant, she drank comfrey leaf infusion with my encouragement and blessing. And when she was lactating, she drank comfrey leaf infusion with my encouragement and blessing. What can I say? You know that if I had any hesitation at all, I wouldn't be able to tell you that.
Well, when I did my initial look for it, the only place I found where they got the PA alkaloids out of the leaf, they were using a type of extraction that no one would be doing in their kitchen. So
exactly.
I'm not sure that you can measure that alkaloid by making an infusion the way you're talking about it. It would be nice to have a study that did that. So actually, the brand of Comfrey Leaf I had, I don't know what I said before, but what I have is Oregon Wild Harvest, the certified organic, and they don't say what country this one is from. So I haven't found Frontier to buy herbs from. I've been getting most of mine from Mountain Rose Herbs. If this were you, I know you can't speak for me. But
they're both wonderful suppliers. I support them and a great number of other places that sell dried herb. They all do a fabulous job, and both Mountain Rose and Frontier are very supportive of herbalists and herbal medicine, and I'm really just can't even describe how thankful and grateful and blessed I am to live in a country that has the support of so many wonderful dealers in good quality dried herbs.
Okay, and if they're getting their herbs from other countries, but they're organic and we're getting them from these places that you've mentioned, you're comfortable with them for your own use?
I can only say to you what I have done, and that is that I have used Comfrey that's labeled Symphytum officinalis. I have bought it from one supplier. I don't know if they have bought it from a variety of places. They've always bought it from the same place. I haven't looked into that thoroughly. I myself certainly have come to no harm. None of my thousands of students who are drinking Comfrey Leaf Infusion have come to any harm.
Okay. So now we'd like to ask about the situation of recovering from surgery, especially anesthesia, because my liver was injured at birth, probably from anesthesia and antibiotics, and so I had been drinking stinging nettle and oat straw, so I fell out of the habit the last week, but we'll be getting back to it. And it's now 5 weeks ago. So it sounds like if this were you speaking for yourself, you would be comfortable adding Comfrey back in now at this point.
Absolutely.
Okay. Anything else that you would do to try to help your liver repair from having gotten anesthesia?
Well, I'm curious as to who told you that your liver was damaged at birth.
The information came through my mother, which it's not always a great source of information in this particular case, but supposedly came from the pediatrician, and then the stories of what I was told happened when I was born and the immediate time afterwards. So apparently, this will sound silly, but she and another woman showed up at the emergency room of a small hospital at the same time, and they decided to deliver the other woman first, so they tied my mother's legs together and down, which apparently wasn't working to stop the birth, so they gave her general anesthesia, and then many hours later, I was born, but required forceps by that time, and my aunt's comment was that I seemed to be either retarded or deaf because I didn't respond to anybody. And then shortly thereafter, my mother had to go on heavy-dose antibiotics, which most of my life I've never been able to tolerate antibiotics. So the combination of the two of them, I wasn't eating well to begin with and apparently completely quit. So about 6 weeks after I was born, I almost died. And then apparently was kind of like mostly non-responsive until 6 months old. So the story that came down to me is that I had probably liver injury from anesthesia. What I notice now is most medications, especially antibiotics, and then caffeine, which is a lab test of liver function, the rate at which people metabolize caffeine. I take a very long time to metabolize caffeine, so I probably have somewhat reduced liver metabolic function.
The herbs that I like best for strengthening the liver are dandelion, chicory, yellow dock, and milk thistle. I don't use them together. I usually just choose one ally and work with that one ally. And so any of these that grow near to you or easily accessible to you or that you feel called to ally with would be, it sounds like a lifetime ally in the same way that I feel that from birth that there was something that prevented my kidneys from being as ideally formed as they could have been. And so I have to take special care of my kidneys. And it's one of the reasons why nettle is such a deep ally to me.
Oh, okay. Well, dandelion is certainly everywhere in my yard, and I don't do anything to kill it. I don't know that I have ready access to the other, although curiously yellow dock showed up in one plant in my yard this year, but normally it's not there. So if I did the dandelion, would I dry it and use it as an infusion?
You could if you don't mind the bitter taste of it. Or you could harvest the leaves and make a leaf vinegar and use that on your salads or your grains.
Okay.
Or you could even make a tincture of the root and use that with meals.
And I don't tolerate alcohol at all. I get really, I like vomit off of even a very small amount of alcohol. So maybe the dandelion vinegar would be something I could do on a regular basis.
That sounds good.
You would be suggesting doing this regularly.
I would be suggesting doing this regularly, absolutely.
If I use milk thistle, how would you use that? And the only way right now I know how to get a hold of that is capsules, which I gather you don't really like.
Well, it's not that I don't like them, it's that capsules are the most expensive, most dangerous, and least effective way to take herbs. So if that appeals to you, well, go ahead. That doesn't appeal to me, but it's not a matter of like or dislike. It's a matter of looking at what I get and saying it's not a good investment. Capsules are not an ideal way to use herbs. They are a way to make herbs look more drug-like. And I don't need my herbs to look more drug-like. So I also see that in every situation in which a great number of people have been injured from taking an herb, it's always been in capsule form. So milk thistle seed tincture is the classic. And I always have people put a small amount of tincture into some water. We're talking 25 drops of tincture per dropperful and 40 dropperfuls in a bottle. So there's a minimum of 1,000 drops of tincture in 1 ounce. Most people's livers can metabolize 1 ounce of alcohol in an hour. What I'm suggesting that you take is 2 drops.
2 drops of milk seed thistle?
Or 2 drops of dandelion tincture. So far as I'm concerned, and I could be wrong, this is not enough alcohol to do anything, and a tincture should always be taken in some liquid. And that could be any liquid you like, from water to fruit juice, and anything in between.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, I suspect you won't even notice the alcohol at that low a dose, but your body will respond to it in a health-promoting way.
So if I try, say, milk thistle, because at least I like what I've read about it, if I were to try the milk thistle seed tincture, 2 drops in water, how often? Several times a day or just once a day?
I would do at least 3 times a day, and if you could do more if you want to.
Okay. And if I was tolerating that, that's something that you you would think about doing long term.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, good. I might be getting to give that a try. Then I had one more question because the red clover are out now. So if I wanted to harvest red clover and dry that, anything special about doing that? Like right now I'm putting it on a paper towel to dry it.
Not okay.
A dark place again, like the other things you mentioned?
Well, I didn't say a dark place. I said a place where no light directly comes in. As a matter of fact, I dry in places where there is light, but the light is very indirect light. So there's like a big eave overhanging, so the sun can't come in directly. Or the light is coming in from the north, so it never comes directly in, even though there's some light in the room. Doesn't have to be in the dark.
Okay.
But no, you cannot dry red clover on paper.
Okay. So how do you dry red clover?
You dry red clover on a basket, a flat basket, or a window screen.
Okay.
Have you gone to wisewomanmentor.com to see any of my e-zines?
I have for several of them, but I haven't looked for red clover yet.
Okay, well, you can't really look for an herb in the e-zine, but what I'm saying is that the e-zine that's going to be published or was published today or tomorrow has a picture of red clover drying on a screen so that you can see how it looks when it's drying, and that is that each blossom must be positioned so it touches no other blossom.
Okay.
Basically, the red clover can't touch anything while it's drying. So if I'm drying it in a flat basket, that basket is hung from the ceiling so that air flows through it from underneath.
Okay.
See, there's a picture of my daughter Justine's red clover drying setup, and she has a couple of sawhorses and a big window screen. That's a pretty stiff window screen, and she has her red clover laid out on that.
Okay.
A little fussy. It's a little picky. You don't want the blossoms to touch. And we're picking just the blossoms with the leaves that are stuck onto them, but we're not picking, like, stalks and leaves, just the very blossoms. And we want the blossoms to be as perfect as possible. We don't want them to be brown. We don't want them to be wet.
Okay. And that actually reminded me of one more question about linden blossoms, which my neighbor tree hopefully soon will be able to be a source for it. And she had offered that to me. When I'm looking on mountain rose herbs, when they sell linden flowers, it's linden flowers and leaves. So for the infusion, is that allowed to have leaves in it, or is it supposed to be just flowers?
The primary difficulty that I have heard people having with mountain roses, linden, is that it is cut. And we talked about what happens when herb gets cut, that it's more open to oxidation and it's more open to change and it's more open to letting itself go. And linden contains a mucilage. When you brew the whole blossom, and many people think that the green part of the blossom is a leaf, but it's not, then you get a really nice linden infusion. When you brew the cut linden, then you get something that resembles half-set jello. So the leaves of linden are dark green, heart-shaped, and bigger than a hand. The green part of the flower is light green, stiff, and about as wide as your finger, but not quite as long.
Okay.
So, again, I don't know, you know, like maybe you're reading something or maybe you've seen something, but there's nothing wrong with using linden leaf. It's just that the flower is the part that's considered to be the most medicinal. Just as if you said to me, well, gee, I thought maybe I'd use ginseng leaf instead of ginseng root. I couldn't say to you that's wrong. I couldn't say to you that's going to be a problem because it's not. But you're not going to get the most oomph there, are you?
Probably not.
Yeah. And Frontier does sell whole linden.
Okay.
That is, and that is what I buy. And, yeah, the linden should be blooming soon. I see it in bud all around me. So within a week or two, usually for the July 4th holiday, the linden is in bloom. And did you say that your neighbor has a tree and she's going to let you harvest some?
Well, she has a giant tree and has agreed to let me harvest it. Her husband says that's like good luck if you can get there before the bees. But we'll see.
Why do you have to get there before the bees? I always wait until after the bees.
Okay.
I don't like to deprive the bees of linden, my goodness.
So
I certainly wouldn't be welcome at any fairy gatherings if I did that.
Okay. So you go after they've stopped visiting the tree as much, or you go later in the day?
I don't try to beat the bees.
Okay.
Is what I'm saying. So I either work with them or do what I need to do, but it's not a matter of my trying to take something out from under the bees. I'm
okay.
Happy to have the bees come then to take the blossoms. They seem just fine to me, even after the bees have visited them.
Okay. The bees have never bothered me where I am. The wasps, yes, but the bees not.
Right.
I planted a linden tree, and it's not acting like it's in a bud this year. So that's
linden trees are often on a two-year cycle, with one year being very sparse and the other one often being quite abundant.
Okay.
And look around and see if there's any linden planted as part of your cityscape or as landscaping in a mall. That's often places where they're found.
Susan,
okay.
We do have three more callers waiting right now, so
all right,
about
let's
20 minutes.
Thank you.
My infusion glass. I'd be happy to have you bring me some infusion, but not that. Next.
All right.
Thanks for letting me know this three more.
Say it again.
Hello.
Hi.
Susan.
Yes.
Your ABC of herbalism student, Colette from Long Island. How are you tonight?
I'm just fine, Colette. Let's see. You had an ovarian cyst back in December.
I certainly did.
And you worked with chickweed.
I certainly did. And had
amazing results. And your doctor couldn't believe the results.
But I have even more amazing news, and I'm going to have copies of my medical documentation sent to you because I have Stony Brook University doctors scratching their heads at this point. I had two saline-ingested sonograms because I was hemorrhaging. I started to hemorrhage, and very badly. My H&H, my hemocritin, my hemoglobin dropped so low, I was sent to the emergency room where they wanted to give me a transfusion. But because my doctor didn't have privileges at the local emergency room, I was turned away. And very grateful for it because I wound up building up my blood supply by your advice. But I want to get first to my two saline-injected sonograms. The first one I had was in middle of March. And they found two polyps. One was 1 centimeter, and one was 0.5 centimeter. And saying, oh, well, you know, you're 51, and we're concerned about this, and it might be cancer, and we have to go do a polypectomy. So I had to change doctors because of insurance, and I wound up going to Stony Brook University Hospital, where they repeated the test, which was maybe 6 weeks after the initial test, repeated the saline injected sonogram. And if anyone has ever had this, it's they put a camera up inside, they open your cervix and put a camera with Christmas lights. It's all bells and whistles, and it completely illuminates your uterus in the saline, floating saline kind of thing. And they found that the two polyps had doubled in size. It was 3 centimeters, which caused them great alarm and saying, oh, we have to do this polypectomy immediately. You're hemorrhaging. Your H&H, your hematocrit, and your hemoglobin are so low. We have to stop the bleeding. We have to take out the polyp. At which point I was reading Down There, your book Down There. And I took the advice of making a white oak bark sitz bath. And I had about 5 or 6 weeks between having the sonogram and my surgery date, which was on June 3rd. So I was making the bath. I wasn't even doing it every day. I was doing it every other day for about 5 minutes. And then 4 days before surgery, I didn't do any of it because I didn't want anything interfering with them going in there and doing histogram and polypectomy and whatever else they were going to do. So they had the pictures that they had taken. They were very concerned about this very large polyp that had tripled in size in a short time. And on June 3rd, at 2:30, I went in for surgery. I opted to have spinal anesthesia and be completely conscious for the procedure. They opened the cervix. They put a camera in. Well, first they inflated my uterus with gas. They put a camera in with lights. And I heard the doctor saying, huh, and the assistant saying, what? And they saying, huh, and what? And they couldn't find the polyp. All they found where the large polyp was a tiny little nub, she said, the size of a pimple. She then said, oh, well, you must have passed it. And I said, I didn't pass anything. I was hypervigilant on anything that was coming out of my body. Did not pass anything. And afterwards, I was asked by the attending physician, and they said, well, you were doing something with some kind of herbal something. I said, yes, I was taking a sitz bath in white oak. I made a little tea and did a sitz bath, and that's all I did. And they're all, So I had my clearance on, my post-surgical clearance on Thursday, and had it with a different doctor from Stony Brook University. And she kept asking me, what did I do? Because they couldn't find the polyp. They wound up doing a complete DNC and had everything sent off. There was no cancer whatsoever, which was what they were concerned about. It had stopped the bleeding. I'm no longer hemorrhaging. And I implemented the things that you advised to raise my blood count. And within 10 days of surgery, my H&H, my hematocrit, my hemoglobin went from 8 over 26 to 11 over 39, which is unheard of, to the point the hematologist came in glowing saying, Colette, you don't need to have a transfusion and you don't need to have any iron infusions. What are you doing? So to say that there is great power in taking control as much as you can of your own health is an understatement. But so we need the information to be able to do that. And if it weren't for you, I would not have had that information to have such not just a positive outcome, but an astounding outcome. And I would be more than happy to share those medical records pertaining to this situation with you.
What a thrill. You know, for all of the decades that I have been doing this, I never stop feeling my heart leap with joy when I hear your story and stories like yours. Green blessings really are everywhere.
Indeed. The one thing that the doctor said is I still have to bring up my iron reserves are low. So I'm taking molasses and yellow dock and eating liver and clams and building my, and of course my you know, nettles are my...
Yay, nettles!
those have been my great allies. But I wanted to say thank you. This has been a very difficult journey, and thank you for listening to my fear and my pain, and thank you for hearing me when I was just freaking out with, oh my God, what am I going to do? And thank you for helping me get through this time, Susan. Thank you.
You are welcome, Colette. Spread the good word about Green Blessings.
Green Blessings. Thanks, Susan.
Bye-bye.
How beautiful was that?
Yes, isn't it wonderful?
So wonderful. And you ready for the next caller? 409 area code.
Hello?
Hello.
Hello, this is Jackie from Texas.
And what's up with you tonight?
Well, I was just calling. I had a question about the difference between using milk thistle and blessed thistle. I know that blessed thistle is the one for to help your breast supply.
So far as I know, they're the same.
Milk thistle, the one that grows here in Texas, is the Psyllabum marinum, and the other blessed thistle that I keep reading about for milk production is the Cnicus Benedictus.
Cnicus, you know.
Yes, please.
There's a lot of discussion about whether or not they're different or the same plants.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think there's much difference at all.
Oh, that's wonderful to know. Because one grows here, one doesn't.
Did you know that artichoke is a thistle?
Nope.
Artichoke is the flower bud of a huge thistle.
Okay.
So that's another place that you can get those compounds is from eating artichokes.
Okay, good. And the milk thistle, if I was to use the Psyllabum marinum, which grows here near me, is it just still the seed that I would use and make it as a tea?
It is usually the seed that is used, yes.
Okay. I've heard of using the stalks and eating those, peeling the outside off and cooking the stalks as a kind of like celery.
Tastes more like an artichoke. It's pretty good. I prefer the root. The root tastes like sweet potato. And all thistles are edible. Leaves, roots, stalks, flowers, flower buds, seeds.
Okay. And you'd want the milk thistle leaves young, right? So they taste good?
They taste good at any time in their growth if you're going to eat them. But you do have to get the thorns off the edges.
Right, okay. Okay. And what about fenugreek?
What about fenugreek?
Also being used for as a imagogue, galactagogue. I'm sorry. To help breast milk come down. I've had this will be my third baby, and I had difficulties breastfeeding the first two, and I really want to be sure that I do everything I can to have a good milk supply this time, because I was able to breastfeed the first one for 3 months and the second one only for a month, because I'm a full-time office manager, and I have to end up going back to work after about 4 weeks, and I can't get it to pump out, and I just didn't have enough, I guess. I didn't have enough milk. I would sit there for hours, and it would just—I just didn't have a supply. And luckily now I know herbs. I've been learning herbs a lot for the last 4 years, and I just want to be ready this time. I want to do everything I can.
So let me ask you this: are you drinking nourishing herbal infusions?
Yes, I'm drinking raspberry leaf infusion. I drink nettle infusion, and I've done milky oat infusion. But, or I should say I've tried oat straw, too, when I ran out of the milky oats. Oat straw,
yeah,
one time, I think I made it extra.
I use the oat straw. So tell me how you make an infusion.
1 ounce of herb to a quart-sized jar of water, and I let it sit for 4 to 8 hours, usually while I'm working, and then towards the end of the day I'll drink it, some of it, and drink the rest the next day. Yeah.
That sounds good. Were you doing that when you had the previous baby?
No, ma'am. I didn't know about herbs back then.
You think so?
My little one's three now.
You know what?
Yeah.
That's all you have to do. That's
okay.
It.
I will.
Just drink your nourishing herbal infusions and don't worry about this other stuff.
Okay. All
really,
right.
You don't need any milk thistle or blessed thistle or fenugreek or anything at all. If drinking the nourishing herbal infusions turns out not to be enough, which you will know within the first week, then if you want to get some fenugreek and make fenugreek tea, you simply put a teaspoonful of fenugreek seeds in a cup, pour boiling water over it, sit down, drink it while you're nursing the baby. It's
fenugreek
not something
tea,
you take.
Tea for nursing?
It's not something you take beforehand. It's something you take while you're nursing the baby.
Okay.
But drink your nourishing herbal infusions now, and I can almost guarantee you that within the range of your lifestyle, you will have plenty of milk. Now, part of what's happening, I know you understand, is that your body is grieving. That when you leave a child that's still a babe in arms, your body grieves. And some women's bodies grieve by shutting down milk.
Okay. Okay.
So human gestation is 18 months. However, our heads get too big to be kept inside. People are always amazed. They say, oh, look at that baby goat. Well, it was just born and it can walk. You say, well, yeah. All mammal babies basically can walk right after they're born, with a few exceptions, and we're one of those exceptions. So we have the last 9 months of our gestation ex utero. But mom and baby are still as deeply linked in the first 9 months of baby's life as they were in the pregnancy. And it is very hard on your body as the mother to leave your baby.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So don't blame yourself. I understand we all have to deal with the economics of being alive. If it's what you need to do, it's what you need to do. But don't blame yourself if you stop making milk.
Yes.
You'll feed that baby as much as you possibly can. 3 months counts. It counts for a lot.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
You are so welcome. Green blessings.
You too.
Well, we have, what, two more?
Two more callers now, yeah.
Before I talk with Doreen Peterson, and Doreen is the president and founder of the American College of Health Care Sciences. Yes, she presents on herbal medicine, holistic health, and has appeared on many TV and radio shows. So we are going to be talking with Doreen Peterson right after I talk to these two callers. Next one.
All right, in the 706 area code.
Hello?
Hi.
Hello. Forgive me. I am recuperating from laryngitis. This is the first day that I've actually been able to speak with my voice.
Ah,
and,
you're blessed.
I've never had laryngitis before. I feel for anyone who has ever lost their voice before. My question is this. I've been following the radio program since you started, and I really feel that my question is maybe a little bit out of bounds. I have been following you for a couple of years, and I know that you're really into, like, herbal health and, you know, all that jazz. But my question is something, I've called you several times with herbal questions before, but this has been a question that's been on my heart, really, for about 2 years. And how do I say, I am curious, how does a woman who is faced, who finds herself in an earth-based spirituality, meaning I go into this earth, and this is where I feel that I belong. This is where I am nurtured. This is where I'm loved. How do I find my archetype? This is a topic that, you know, I attend the Southeastern Women's Herbal Conference several years. I saw you last year, and it's just really been something since I found out about archetypes, I guess about 2.5 years ago, and for the past 2 years, something, I mean, I guess for 6 months, it just never really bothered me. I was just so wound up in so many other things, you know, herbal medicine and health and everything else, that to find my spiritual guide just really doesn't seem so important. I wanted to find out
I'm so sorry that I have to cut you short, but I really do want to get to the other caller before Doreen.
Oh, I'm
and
sorry.
So that
no.
Does mean that I only have 2 minutes with you. And so the short answer to your question is you call out to your goddess archetype. Before you go to sleep at night, you say, goddess archetype, come to me in my dreams. When you wake up in the morning, you say, goddess archetype, show yourself to me during the day. When you are standing in line at the supermarket, look around and say, is my goddess archetype here? Simply focus yourself on it, call out to your goddess archetype, and she will make herself known to you. Dream blessings.
Thank you.
And the last caller, Rebecca.
All right, in the 907 area code. Hello, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Great speaking with you. My question is about herbs and IBS or any kind of digestion issues. What do you recommend?
Well, what I recommend for anyone is nourishing herbal infusions. Mm-hmm. Nourishing herbal infusions are extraordinarily useful for people with gut problems on a wide variety of levels. First of all, they can help replace gut flora.
Uh-huh.
Secondly, they contain polyphenols, which are very active and healthy in the gut. And most importantly, they nourish us, and they nourish us optimally and deeply. And I believe that the vast majority of health problems, really, when we get into it, are simply a matter of not having the nourishment that we need in order to do that function or to create that organ in perfection.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry that I have to cut you short, but our guest, Doreen Peterson, is on the line. And as you heard from tonight, we welcome repeat callers. So if I haven't given you a lavish enough answer, please do call back. Green blessings. And Doreen Peterson, as I said, is president and founder of the American College of Healthcare Sciences. She's been in all kinds of TV and radio shows. Good Morning Oregon, the national radio show Voice of America, Better Portland. She has lots of articles about herbal medicine, and they have occurred in all kinds of publications. And She has a white paper that she presented at the Asian Aroma Ingredients Congress, and she's a professional member of the American Herbalist Guild. As a matter of fact, she was awarded the Professional Service Award from the International Herb Association for outstanding contributions to the herb industry. Welcome to the show, Doreen Peterson.
Susan, thank you. It's delightful to be chatting with you again, and thank you very much for having me on the show.
I am so thrilled to have you here. You know, each one of us who's gotten involved in herbal medicine always has an interesting story of how we got there. And I think this follows so beautifully on the question that I was just asking. I don't know if you were able to hear, but she said, how do I find my goddess archetype? And I said, call out for it and it will come to you. Did you call out to herbal medicine or did herbal medicine grab you?
I think herbal medicine grabbed me. I grew up in a family that spent time foraging. My grandmother was, you know, out in the fields digging dandelion and yellow dock and brewing up all sorts of foul-tasting brews in the kitchen. And it's how I grew up. It's what I got used to. And I was fascinated in plants. I ended up studying at university, got a degree in ethnobotany and archaeology. And actually, after graduation, started working as a medical social worker in quite a large public hospital, saw a huge need for education and particularly, you know, preventative educational approach. Went on to do a naturopathic training in New Zealand, a four-year naturopathic degree, ran a busy clinic, and there I really saw a need for education. And then my second year of naturopathic college, I founded the extramural distance department for that college, and that college became the what is now the American College of Healthcare Sciences, or ACHS, and we're now 37 years old. So really educating others in wellness has been my whole life, and, you know, wellness incorporating all kinds of holistic modalities as well as herbal medicine. So I think it grabbed me, but probably I was also, you know, really passionate about it from a very young age.
Yes, I love that. And people often comment about that with my daughter and my granddaughter, and they say, oh, what a wonderful start your granddaughter is getting. And I say, yes, herbal medicine seems normal to her.
Yeah, isn't that great? My grandkids are the same. I mean, they know about plants, will be out walking, and they know, you know, they can recognize dandelions and yellow docks and know about digging up roots, and I love that. It's just part of life, what you do.
Yes, herbal medicine is people's medicine. It's the medicine mm-hmm. that's right outside our doors, and although there's certainly room for people, if people want to have licenses and do that. As you know, I am absolutely, completely opposed to licensure of herbal medicine or herbalists. I want herbal medicine to be people's medicine. I want us to remember that even a three-year-old can do herbal medicine.
I have to agree with you, Susan. I think it's important that you know, we appreciate the long tradition of herbal medicine, but I am really excited to bring the traditional aspects of herbal medicine and that people's medicine and the science of holistic health and herbal medicine together. And, you know, really my whole life has been making available, you know, online accredited degrees and modalities. Not just herbal medicine, but aromatherapy and holistic nutrition. And I just think it's great to provide training. I mean, I know you do too, and you've done some absolutely fantastic things with everything and all your wonderful books and really empowered people to use the plants around them. And what really inspires me is to train graduates who can go out there and, you know, really stand up side by side with, you know, any healthcare professional in more mainstream situations. And, you know, when I first came here 28 years ago, I really didn't see, from New Zealand, I really didn't see much complementary alternative medicine in the United States. There was a lot more going on in New Zealand. But now I'm really seeing it, which is very exciting. You know, I mean, just things like the health freedom, I think, is really exciting. You know, the health freedom laws that are passing in many states. I think most recently, I think there's 9 states now where practitioners, unlicensed or not, you know, unlicensed or licensed, can practice complementary alternative medicine as long as they adhere to what each specific state is requiring. So, I mean, that's terrific.
Yes, that is quite remarkable. And what a wonderful return that we've had. You know, it's like we had 100 years of drug insanity. And I often like to tease, you know, that we have Filter and Lloyd, you know, the last physician's desk reference for herbal medicine in 1899, and then the new physician's desk reference for herbs in 1999. So a complete 100 years passed in which we were being told, oh, no, herbs, that's backwards. We don't do that anymore. And with your work and the work of so many hundreds of other wonderful herbalists in the United States, that we have been able to wake people up to the medicines in their backyard. And to one of the things that I have long wanted it to be, and that is integrative medicine, because when I started studying it and people said that this was alternative, I said, I'm not alternative to anything. I work with, not against. And I think that has been so much the message that you have brought as well, is work together, not against each other.
Exactly. Integration is, I mean, it has to be integrative. And you know, it really, I see it as prevention too. I mean, what excites me is to see herbal medicine and integrative medicine as more of a prevention, more wellness. It's what you do every day. And that's why I love doing our study abroad programs. You know, I've been taking students and really anyone who wants to come. You don't have to be a student with us. To countries such as Indonesia, where you can walk into any little store and get a herbal drink. They call it jamu, and there's jamu women walking around the streets offering you, you know, freshly brewed turmeric drinks and all sorts of wonderful things. I mean, it's just part of their everyday life. And, you know, I'm seeing that more and more here, where that just, you know, it's becoming part of what we can do on a daily level. The other thing I'm really enjoying is seeing things, you know, like hospitals that are really bringing in a lot more integrative medicine. You know, one of the groups that I've been doing a little bit of work with is Plane Tree. There's a hospital group that really seem to be doing amazing work. I mean, putting in aromatherapy rooms, bringing in, you know, trained aromatherapists, trained herbal medicine professionals, and really, you know, living the integrative approach. I think it's exciting.
Plane Tree has been around for quite a long time, haven't they?
I think they have. I'm not sure when they originated, but, you know, what I'm excited to see is just they're really reaching out and, you know, making available a real wide array of holistic health modalities that a patient can choose from, and really putting the patient's needs first, which, you know, a lot of hospitals and a lot of drug model pharmacy-type situations don't really do. And, you know, when you were talking about pharmacopoeias, I love going back and reading all the old pharmacopoeias, you know, looking at the formulas and, you know, just seeing how, you know, what people were working with in those days. And it's extremely interesting.
I actually generally think that most people get the health care that they want. And what do I mean by that? Well, let me give you an example. A friend of mine who had been complaining of mild gastrointestinal things for quite some time called me from the hospital. And she said her intestines ruptured. And she was taken to the hospital, and they cut out part of her intestine and gave her a bag, and she wanted to know what kind of herbs to use. And I said to her that I could have been some real help to her 8 years previously, 5 years previously, even 2 years previously, but that she now had the health care that she wanted because she had paid no attention to herself.
Yeah, it's,
and
the
people who do pay attention to themselves
mm-hmm.
are the ones who wind up working with integrative medicine because these are people who have some motivation to do something. And this is irrespective of our economic status. I have met very motivated people who are of a very low economic status and very unmotivated people who have a very high economic status. I do not think this is attached to money. I think it's attached to partly what you were saying is, what do we grow up with? What do we think is normal? Is it normal to take care of ourselves, or is it normal to ignore ourselves?
I think you make a very good point. I think I'm not sure that it's motivation, however. You know, I truly feel it's education. I think when you present people, again, I agree, I don't think it's anything to do with a socioeconomic status. I think it's to do with, well, socio, yes, because if you're not educated to live life as if knowing that if everything you do every day is really what is going to affect you in the long term. You know, wellness is not something you, like you said, your friend, unfortunately, if she'd taken care previous, 8 years previous, she wouldn't be in the situation she's in. But a lot of people don't realize that. They don't realize that what they're doing every day is going to eventually going to impact them down the road. And I know certainly leading a life of wellness, you know, and I mean, everyone's on a different path is not something that is necessarily easy. But I think when people are presented with simple things you can do, easy things you can do, you know, I mean, just going back to the Jawa of Indonesia, how do you add something like turmeric into your everyday life? It's really simple. I mean, a couple of teaspoons of organic turmeric powder thrown in your smoothie in the morning tastes great, and it's a wonderful anti-inflammatory. Something as easy as that. There's probably something equivalent growing, you know, outside your back door. But, I mean, that can be a little more involved because then you've got to go and harvest it, dig it up, know about it even more. But something simple like a spice from the local store that you can sprinkle on your food, throw in your smoothie, include in your everyday life. You know, those are the things that I think are really important that I think, you know, we need to get out there and just really help people see how simple it is to incorporate into your life.
That people already have herbal medicines in their house. They don't have to go out and buy them. They're called their spices and seasoning herbs.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you know, what is actually in your cupboard is powerful stuff. So, you know, because it's not easy for everyone to get out in the field and even dig a dandelion. I mean, let alone find a dandelion. You know, if you're talking about suburban America, in fact, one of the labs that we teach is just that. We send people out into their local environment and searching for dandelions and, you know, learn how to identify something as simple as a dandelion or a yellow dock and, you know, both incredibly powerful plants. So,
yes, and all around most people in most areas of North America. And certainly it is wonderful, as I have been saying this evening, that we have such wonderful suppliers of good quality herbal material in the United States, that we don't have to rely on herbs in capsules, which basically scare me because, gee, every time I hear of something bad happening with people in herbs, they've been taking it in capsules, and I can rarely find anything bad happening to people who take herbs in ways where they can actually encounter them. I certainly, you know, tell people that you certainly don't need to harvest all of your own. Or one of my past apprentices was just visiting this weekend, and she's very, very busy. And she said, you know what she does is she just harvests a little bit of the herbs she uses for infusion, and then she buys most of what she uses, and she puts a little bit of her home-harvested herb in, and she says that makes her feel like she has a real connection to it and a real ownership to it. And I think this is so important in health, and it's certainly one of the things that is missing when people take pills.
I love that idea. I agree. I think it's really important to work with whole herbs. And, you know, any time a herb is powdered and placed in a capsule, well, number one, you powder anything, as you know, Susan, and you start, it starts oxidizing, you start losing vital active constituents, and you really can't identify it once it's in powder form. So, you know, one of the things I'm neurotic about is I will not buy powdered herbs. You know, we buy everything whole, and if necessary, you know, we will powder it, but you know, I think if somebody really finds encapsulated herbs easier to take, then I certainly wouldn't say, no, don't take them because they're in a capsule. But you can make your own capsules, too. It's kind of fun. It's a great thing to do while you're sitting watching TV or, you know, hanging out with friends.
I would say, again, no, don't take the herbs if you could only take it in a capsule. I really would.
You would say what?
I would say don't use herbs if you can only take them in a capsule.
Oh, you would, yeah.
I would say you're better off with drugs.
Oh, yeah, no, I would not agree with that.
But then again, I'm perhaps a little more hardcore. I, you know.
Yeah.
As we're saying, there has to be a little bit of interaction between the person and the herb. Now, herbalists for years and years, decades have been talking about synergy, right? And the synergy of the many different constituents of the herbs. And I think that among many of the things that are lost once we powder an herb is that we lose all of that synergy. And so, in fact, we turn the herb into an inferior drug by powdering it and putting it in a capsule.
Well, that's an interesting theory, and as I said, you know, the minute you powder a herb, you're losing active constituents, and I agree, you're losing some intrinsic potency there that, you know, isn't just based on the physical, with some etheric quality lost
But, you know, but capsules are like the past. What's happening in the future? Where do you see us going to?
Well, that's a really interesting question. You know, I hate to say it, but I see more encapsulated herbs now. I mean, you walk into any health food store, and there's a lot of botanicals now being encapsulated. Not many people are really using herbs as, you know, you and I would really love to see people using herbs, making herb teas, making decoctions. You know, one of the easiest things I found, and I love to encourage people to do this, is, you know, make your decoction, make your herb tea, and put it in your drink bottle, you know, with ice and cold water, and drink it throughout the day, even if it's diluted. That's another great way to take your herbs as infusions and decoctions. Or you can put your tinctured herbs in your drink bottle throughout the day. I'm just a great believer in making it easy for people, because people are busy. people have, you know, really crazy, stressful lives. And at what point do you say to someone, it's better to do something with herbal medicine than nothing at all? You know, I would much rather somebody took a capsule than took a drug. And just to start people realizing that, you know, it's easy. You can do it. You can put it into your life. Where I see it going, you know, I just see herbal medicine as becoming more and more powerful in this country. I mean, there's a lot of great organizations, American Herbalist Guild, the American Botanical Council, the American Herbal Products Association. They're all great organizations doing great work. Aromatherapy, I think, is becoming very powerful in this country. I love to see, you know, aromatherapy and herbal medicine and a lot of the modalities all being used together. I think that is a really interesting approach. So, and particularly with, the focus on wellness now, I mean, there's this, huge movement now with the Affordable Care Act for wellness, and I just think the healthcare industry is slowly, you know, making that integration more of a focus. I think it's really exciting. I think there's a lot of jobs opening up. I think it's definitely really a best time that I've ever seen here in the time I've been living here.
Yes, I too think that where we're going is into greater numbers. And I've been actually talking about this to herbalists for over 10 years, in that when we are working with greater numbers, stranger things are going to happen. You know, you think, I was one of the first women to take birth controls in the United States. And I think that they had, like, maybe completed one study with a couple thousand women in Puerto Rico when I started taking birth control pills.
Oh, wow.
And look at how much more we know now that millions of women have taken hundreds of millions of doses. And that happens with herbs, too. When, you know, when it was a tight little cliquey community in the 70s and 80s, it was easier, shall we say, to get standardized results. Because we were working with more standardized people. Now we are touching a much broader spectrum of people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very exciting. And, like when I say, I would rather that they would take a drug, what I would really rather is that I would so shock them by that statement that they would say, I don't want to take a drug. I want to really get involved with herbs. I like to push people a little bit. Instead of going along with their kind of, attitude, I like to push them to get a little involved, to get a little active.
I always love that about you, Susan. do you remember when you came to New Zealand?
Absolutely. I've been in New Zealand 3 times, and I love it, and I loved the time that we spent together. As a matter of fact, I was just listening to Isla Burgess on a tape in my car today.
Oh, terrific, terrific.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that edge that you have, I mean, that force that you are, it's powerful, and I think it's important. And, I do think that the more you can, really reach people at the level they're at with, some comfort, but then, obviously there has to be some, shockwave there. I mean, take your friend, for example, how unfortunate that now, 8 years later, if somehow you had reached her 8 years ago, if somehow she had, had some awareness of symptomatically that things were not feeling great, and she was heading down some pathway that, she's now ended up at, you could have reached somebody like that if you were really able to shock someone into doing something that was a little outside of the comfort zone.
Well, and Doreen, that is exactly the kind of experience that has made me the kind of activist that I am, because I have seen the times when I didn't do that, when I just said, we'll just go along with them and what they're doing. And I've, these are the only things I've ever regretted in my life, is that I wasn't pushier. And I'm sure the people who know me will laugh and say, I can't believe she's saying the only thing she regrets is she's not pushy enough.
But I think everybody needs an advocate, and everybody needs a good, you know, a kick in the butt every now and again.
Every once in a while.
You know. And you're that person. That's great.
Oh, my gosh. Indeed. Well, you know, we are just so blessed to have you working for all of us and working for our better health and working in places where not all of us are willing to go. You know, I really feel that about you, that you have this blessed way of walking into places that some of us, you know, would think, oh, my goodness, there's no way I could get along with those people. And yet you find ways to get what seems to me to be rather disparate people to work really well together.
Well, thank you. I do enjoy creating collaborative environments and, bringing what would seem to be, you know, something from the outside into areas that, just to give you an example, and I know we're running out of time, but just to give you a quick example, when the college was first founded here in Oregon, we had to become licensed in the state of Oregon, and the official who came to visit with us, you know, he was standing in our little college store looking at all the botanicals and the essential oils saying, well, you know, what on earth is this? You know, I mean, what do you mean, aroma what? Aromatherapy? He'd never heard of such a thing. I mean, we're talking 25 years ago, right? And he said, when I was explaining it to him, he looked at me and he said, oh, you mean that's like my wife giving me melatonin? I'm like, absolutely. That's exactly what it is. So, I mean, you know, obviously it isn't, but along the same kind of line. So those are the people we're kind of reaching.
Absolutely. So I have been very negligent because I should have in the middle said, hey, you're listening to Doreen Peterson, and you can get in touch with her at www.achs.edu. I know, that's a different ending for many of you. Edu, it's about education, so it's www.a, the first letter of the alphabet, C, the third letter of the alphabet, HS, like high school, ACHS. It is really the American College of Healthcare Sciences .edu. Doreen Peterson, what do you want to leave the listeners thinking about?
Well, Susan, thank you very much for having me. It's delightful to reconnect with you. And, I just think it's important that people get excited to walk outside, take a look at the plants growing around them, and start to think about the medicine chest that's in our backyards. And, just try and connect with a herbalist in their local environment and start learning about what you can do with the plants around you. It's exciting.
It certainly is. Green blessings are everywhere. Thank you, Doreen Peterson.
Thank you,
for
Susan,
helping us reweave the healing cloak of the ancients. And remember, everybody, herbal medicine is people's medicine. It's the medicine right outside your door. Good night, everybody.